This is Storybeat, Storytellers on Storytelling, an exploration into how master storytellers and artists develop and build brilliant stories and works of art that people everywhere love and admire. So join us as we discover how talented creators of all kinds find success in the worlds of imagination and entertainment. Here now is your host, Steve Cuton.
Thanks for joining us on Storybeat. We're coming to you from the Center for Media Innovation on the campus of Point Park University in the heart of downtown Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. If you like this podcast, please take a moment to give us a rating or review on whatever app or platform you're listening to. Your support helps us bring more great Storybeat episodes to you. Well, my guest today, Rocky Lang, has been involved in the motion picture and television business all his life. He's produced, written, and directed motion pictures, documentaries, television shows, movies of the week, and miniseries. Growing up as the son of veteran producer and Universal Studios executive Jennings Lang, Rocky knew early on that he wanted to write, produce, and direct. He's made 5 documentary films, including the award-winning The Making of Tootsie and Spinners, which won the 2013 Best Documentary Award at the Los Angeles Film and Script Festival. Directing assignments have included the long-running hit show Remington Steele, as well as 3 features, Nervous Ticks, Race for Glory, and All's Fair. Rocky also produced White Squall, starring Jeff Bridges and directed by Ridley Scott, and he also produced the Emmy Award-winning Titanic, a 4-hour miniseries for CBS. As an award-winning screenwriter, Rocky has worked with most of the major studios and networks and sold material to numerous production companies. Over the years, he's worked with such luminaries as Dustin Hoffman, Jessica Lange, Jackie Gleason, Clint Eastwood, Sidney Pollack, Terry Garr, Sally Kellerman, George Segal, Peter Berg, Jeff Bridges, John Savage, and many more. Rocky is also the author of 8 books, including How I Broke Into Hollywood, Confessions of Emergency Room Doctors, The Big Nasty, Growing Up Hollywood, Lara Takes Charge, and if you thought your divorce was bad, wait until you read this book. He's also authored a series of empowering books aimed at children with diabetes. His book, Lara Takes Charge, is in the hands of over 40,000 children, hospitals, and libraries. On May 29, 2008, the American Diabetes Association honored Rocky as Father of the Year for his advocacy for children living with diabetes. He's currently at work on the book Letters from Hollywood for Abrams Books, due out September of 2019, a little later this year. Tennis has been Rocky's lifelong passion. He's a certified professional and member of the United States Professional Tennis Association. For more information about Rocky, please visit rockylang.com. Well, it's truly a great honor and a real pleasure for me to have Rocky Lang as my guest on Storybeat today. Rocky, welcome to the show.
What a treat to speak to you this morning, and thank you for reading my book and reaching out to me.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm sure we're going to hear some great stories and learn a few things along the way. So obviously, you grew up as a child in and of Hollywood. At what age did you start to get interested in the movies? From very little boy?
Well, very little, no. I mean, probably, I think it all changed for me in fifth grade, and I did not like it all to be assigned book reports for the books that we read. So I went to my teacher and I said, how about if I write a screenplay adaptation of S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders and go make the movie with my friends, and that'll be my book report. So she had never heard that, but she said, hey, there's writing involved and all that, go for it. So my friends and I, we went to one of our houses and we shot this film and we put music to it, and we ran it, and there was a lot of positive reactions to it, and it sort of like fueled me into it, and I continued to make these Super 8 movies all through elementary school, a little bit into high school, where I transitioned at that point into doing television. Mm-hmm. And at Beverly Hills High School, which was amazing in the 70s, is they had a class called Media Service, and right. They had acquired the Image Orthicon cameras from the Ed Sullivan Show and had a studio.
Wow.
And an old switcher. So I actually learned television directing and television producing, in that environment, and wound up to direct 60 television shows before I was 19.
Wow.
In a a cable market in Beverly Hills, which is very, very limited. It just went out to the Beverly Hills community on a channel called EECH, Theta Channel E, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so just really young, you know, I wanted to be like, you know, baseball player, heart surgeon, you know, airline pilot, you know, all of that. But it changed when I got to be about 12, you know, 11, 12 years old.
And so you're saying you actually worked on 60 productions before you were 20 years old?
I did, but let's put that into context. You know, we're at the high school in the studio. It was a real studio, although it was a studio probably that would look more mirrored like the late 1940s and early 50s.
Right.
But we actually had three cameras, and we did live shows, and they went out, and they were all kinds of shows. They were public interest. They were news. They were variety. I produced and directed a show called the Norman News Service, which was high school news. And then one of the things that actually got me an article in Teen Magazine, which was is I came up with a show called Warm Hearts and Cold Noses, which was a pet adoption show. Before you see all these pet adoption shows, you know, on local news, and I got the SPCA to come in with the dogs, and we put out this show once a week about here are these dogs, come, you know, adopt them. And yeah, so we did 60 of those, and then I graduated and I went to work. I don't know if you want me to just, you know, do a lineage, but then I got a job with ABC Sports mm-hmm. as the low man on the totem pole at the Montreal Olympics.
Right.
And it was quite an experience because I was pretty young. I think I was 17 then, not even out of high school. And I went to Montreal and by myself and wound up actually being assigned to Howard Cosell. But there was nothing for me to do there. I mean, I never met Howard. It was just basically doing the Xeroxing in the office, and I didn't really want to do that. So I got transferred out to Robert Rieger's film crew. And Robert Rieger, for your listeners who are not familiar with him, is a multi-Emmy Award-winning director and cameraman who created sort of the concept of, which he called at that time, up close and personal.
Right.
And they were sort of the bio pieces that ran during the Olympics about an athlete. Now we see them all the time, but he was the guy who sort of started that. And so I was assigned the film crew, and I, you know, schlepped batteries around and changed out film and had my hands in the bag and got sort of friendly with everybody. And it was a wonderful experience in the end. It wasn't that easy, and it wasn't, you know, all the time that enjoyable. But it was, and I get to see as many sports as I wanted to see. I was like, oh, wow, I get to go to the Olympics. I'm going to see all the sports. Well, I actually didn't. And spent, you know, a whole day, you know, in a sort of like a foxhole waiting for Princess Anne from England to come by with her horse. You know, so it's like that kind of thing. But anyway, what it did do, which was interesting, is that it sort of formulated a direction for me because I loved sports. I always, you know, big Dodger fan, big Rams fan. My dad and I shared that very much together, our love of sports. And I thought that might be an interesting career for me to go in the sports world. But then I realized sort of through this experience that I'm not sure how much fun it would be, you know, to creatively to do sports because, you know, look at a third and long pass in football. I mean, you isolate the wide receivers and you look back for a pass and, you know, sort of that's the play. And so from a narrative standpoint, I just felt like maybe I should go more in the dramatic direction, which was sort of always where I had my heart had been, even as a little kid.
This is at 20 years old or so?
I'm about 17, 18 years old, sort of playing this out in my head
mm-hmm.
right now at this point. And, you know, certainly I talked to my dad about it because we were very close, and my mom. And, you know, he was very careful not to point me in any one direction or not. In fact, I can only think of a couple of things that he said that were you know, questioning certain choices I had. And so anyway, that was it. It led into me ultimately then at 19 years old, where sort of, I guess, nepotism comes in a certain way, is that my dad was doing a movie in Borough Park, Brooklyn called Nunzio, a little known movie, a wonderful film directed by a director named Paul Williams, who did The Revolutionary with John Voight,
mm-hmm.
and just a very talented David Proval from Mean Streets was in it. It was a small film, and my dad was eager to do it because he grew up in Borough Park. He started from nothing. He was a Depression kid and, you know, came out to Hollywood and made his name. And so he wanted to make a movie sort of late in his career that was back in his neighborhood. So it was a small film. He convinced the movie just to do it. And And I wanted to go to New York for the summer, so he got me a job at a place called General Camera. And General Camera was on 11th Avenue, probably around 38th to 39th Street in New York back in the day when there was a lot of, you know, prostitution on the streets, and it was a very different time in the late 70s in New York.
Yes, it was.
And so I, you know, I get off the bus, and, you know, I, like, on 11th Avenue, I start walking down there, and I'm passing, you know, hookers who are carrying Listerine bottles with them, and there's this outside sort of depot for taxi cabs and buses. And as I'm walking towards the General Camera building, all of a sudden I hear the Stars and Stripes Forever blasting out of, like, the sixth story. And I look up, and there's this telephoto lens, and these guys are applauding. And then out of a taxi comes a guy with his pants down running across the thing. And the hooker gets out afterwards. And these guys would sit up there with their long cameras and, like, do this a couple of times a day when they had a break and, you know, carry on. And this was the building that I was going into at 19, still a virgin. Okay? Just going into this world. I just turned 19. And so, you know, I meet these guys, and they're great. And I do, you know, I sweep the floors. I put the battery packages together. I do all the crap work, which was wonderful. I learned about lenses. And they were the East Coast distributor for Panavision. So at that time, Panaflex was, you know, the state-of-the-art camera. And actually, people don't know that Panaglide was the precursor to Steadicam. And so I was playing with the Panaglide unit before there was even a Steadicam really out there. It was pretty much fun stuff. So anyway, my dad's now shooting this movie out in Borough Park. And I convinced Dick DeBona, who was the president of General Camera, to let me, you know, take an old Aeroflex 16mm and go out to the set. And I talked to my dad. I said, I'd like to make a movie about the making of your movie. And I think it's a really interesting story. And so, you know, he got it okay from the studio, and, you know, and it became part of the publicity thing. And every day after I finished with General Camera, I'd go out to the set, and I'd spend, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours out there shooting this movie called When Hollywood Comes to Brooklyn. And what it was really not just a featurette, because they did use it for publicity, but what I found it's fascinating is that here is this town, a Borough Park, and people lived in that town, were born there, they went to school there, they got married there, they worked there, they had their own children there, and their own grandchildren there, and then they died. And many of them never even crossed over to Manhattan.
No.
And this was their existence. And so what happens when a major studio motion picture comes into that neighborhood and involves the people who live in that neighborhood in the production of the film? And I thought that was an interesting concept to approach a making of movie. And so that's what I did. And, you know, it was a most amazing experience, because 1977 was the summer of Son of Sam.
Right.
It was the hottest. At that point, it was like the hottest summer on record, where the Con Ed blackout happened. It was the Dodgers and the Yankees were vying for a World Series, so that was heated. And it was the birth of disco music, because Saturday Night Fever had been just released, and Studio 54 had emerged. And it was this crazy period of time. And for me, as, you know, evolving as a young man and having all this experience around me after having a relatively sheltered existence growing up in Beverly Hills, California,
mm-hmm.
It was really, you know, mind-blowing. And I was witness to things that were, like, absolutely, like, crazy stuff. Like the mafia, the head of the mafia had a granddaughter, and he was scared to death that she was going to get shot by the Son of Sam. So the mafia and the cops got together to sort of, like, put a piece and say, how can we help each other in finding this lunatic? And that was, like, getting negotiated on the set of the movie. And I was, like, listening to this stuff. And it was nuts. And then and before that happened, because now there's a good relationship with the local mobs, is before that even happened, is that my dad took me up to a place called Rao's, which is now pretty famous because they've got their own pasta sauce and spaghetti sauce out of stores. But Rao's at the time was, and it probably still is, it was up in Harlem. And at that point in the 70s, it was a very dangerous area to be in. But Rao's was, like, the safest place to go in the world. Nobody touched that street because the mob owned the Rao's. And so I went there with my dad for dinner. And this is right before the movie started. Drive up there in the limousine, go in. There's this guy, like, you know, I don't remember the name of the Carmine Vincent, or somebody's, like, you know, hugs my dad, and he comes out of the kitchen with a bloody apron on, like cooking, cutting the meats. And he sits down with us, and you know, he apparently this guy was an underboss, or he was someone significantly high in whatever that family was. And he liked to come into the restaurant like twice a week and cook. He just, that was his sort of thing. And so he, you know, we're sitting there talking, and my dad says, you know, why don't you take Rocky back and show him the lettuce?
The lettuce.
And so, I'm sorry?
I said the lettuce. Yes,
the lettuce. Okay, right, the lettuce. So he sort of laughs, and, you know, and we go back in the kitchen, and, you know, I walk through the kitchen, and then we go to this huge refrigerator, and it's like this massive refrigerator where there's like, it's like the scene in Rocky, you know, there's like the hanging cow is like, you know, hanging from the ceiling, and there's like a pig, yeah, and all this crap is going on, and all this other stuff. He goes to this back room, and he opens this other small refrigerator. Or, I'm not even sure if it was a refrigerator, but this box that was locked, and he opens it up, and there are these like five heads of lettuce in it. They're just sitting there, and I'm like thinking, why is lettuce in the freezer? I mean, that's got to be horrible. And he pulls one of the heads of lettuce back, and there's like, I don't know how much money was there, $200,000? I have no idea. There's a huge wad of money hidden behind the lettuce.
And in those days, $200,000 was a lot of money.
I don't know if it was 20. That might have been $25,000. From my eyes, I didn't count it. I was looking at it, and I went, wow, that's a big load of money. And so anyway, my dad never confirmed it to me, but what was happening was, is that the Teamsters, which were controlled by that family, had threatened unless they got more Teamster drivers on the production that they would start cutting the tires of the production vehicle and making it impossible to shoot the movie.
Yeah.
So they had to come to a deal. And part of the deal was to put on more Teamster drivers. And probably some of that money there had to go to a donation to whatever the cause was that they wanted the cause donated to. I never got confirmation on it, but that's sort of how it was. My dad, with a twinkle in his eye, sort of indicated it to me.
So your training was in the streets. You didn't go to school for any of this, did you?
I did go to AFI. I went to the American Film Institute. But my dad was a strong believer that if I really wanted to do this, I needed to know everything I could about the film business.
Sure.
So what he did is, so that was instilled in me very early. So I went and studied with Lee Strasberg. I, you know, put the camera units together. I learned how to write, even though I didn't want to be a writer, because I wanted to know the fear of facing a blank page.
Of course.
I learned cameras and lenses and lighting. And I even learned distribution. There, I went to work with Pacific Theaters one summer as an intern, where I saw what happened after the film was distributed and delivered to the theaters, and how that percentage worked, and how concessions worked, and basically, you know, how you gave room to a film to grow without like leaving a film in the theaters with four people in the audience. So he was instrumental in getting me to understand that I needed to understand all aspects of the film business, because it would make me a better director.
No question.
Which is what my goal was.
No question. The more know in the business, the better you're going to be.
Absolutely. It was a great experience. Being on that. So anyway, I came back from Brooklyn, had this film done. And then I sort of still at UCLA, and I applied. I didn't even tell my dad this. I applied to UCLA, to AFI, to their master's program before I had graduated UCLA, because I didn't expect to get in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people were in their 30s, you know, and they'd had significant work. But I sent in this film I did, this thing I did in Brooklyn. And I guess it's because it wasn't just a promotional film. There had some, you know, other things going on in it that they liked it, and they accepted me into the program. And my dad was quite shocked, and they were actually quite shocked because I never pulled the card. And I never pulled the card because it wasn't really the way I did things, but also I didn't expect to get in. So
right.
I just sort of went ahead. So I got that year at AFI, which was a mixed bag for me. And I can tell your listeners who want to get into the film business, one of the great quotes ever by a man named Tony Villani, who was the head of the film directors program there
right.
for many years. And the first day that I went to AFI, he had the directing fellows sit down on the couch, and he said, listen, you guys, he says, the one thing I'm going to promise you that you will get out of your year at AFI is at the end of it, you will be older. And so, you know, we're there thinking, like, he's going to tell us, this is going to get us our first job.
Sure.
This is going to send us off on our career. And, you know, and it was a really bizarre year for me. I mean, I can honestly say that the year at AFI did nothing for me as a filmmaker, but it taught me a lot of things about navigating the politics of dealing with, you know, producers, writers, other directors, jealousy, envy, you know, all sorts of emotions that fly around whenever you have similar people competing for attention and notoriety and trying to move their career. You know, it's sort of probably a mini version of law school. My daughter's in law school now, so I mean, I hear some of her stories. So, you know, maybe it's something like that. And that was really interesting moving forward from there. And, you know, so I, you know, that was good. And then I went and did a few more of these making ofs and ultimately landed me with, you know, the making of Tootsie, which was without a doubt the most formative year of my life. And outside of my father, Sidney Pollack was the most influential person on my career and the way I approached movies.
Extraordinary talents.
Absolutely. It was the most amazing situation, and I was right in the middle of all the conflict between Dustin and Sidney that wound up in the big fight in the Columbia parking lot. I don't know how much you want me to go into that, but you know, it was really
tell that story. Tell the story of Dustin Hoffman and Sidney Pollack in the parking lot.
Okay, well, let me back up and give some context.
Sure.
So, Tootsie was originally a script that Dustin had developed called Shirley, and it was written by Murray Siskel. And so Shirley was, I think, probably Dustin got the idea from Renee Richards, the man who became a woman and played professional tennis.
Right,
Richard
right.
Rastin was a very well-known ophthalmologist, and he always was a tennis player. And so he was the first sort of transgender person to go and play in the women's game. And so Dustin sort of like took that idea into this comedy called Shirley. It went through various different drafts. It ultimately became Tootsie. There was, you know, a number of directors attached to it. And he wanted Sidney to direct. It finally came to Sidney. He wanted Sidney to do the film. And so Sidney took it on the condition that he had final control. He wasn't going to, you know, do it. So Dustin turned over control to Sidney. So now they go off to make the movie. And they are having fights all along the film that are not monumental. And I had full access. That was part of my deal with Sidney, that there would be no place that I couldn't go with my camera.
Right.
He was phenomenal. And so there were skirmishes, but nothing really big. And they basically had to do with tonality. So, like, whereas Sidney felt the movie was really about a man putting on a dress and becoming a man because of it, Dustin felt that the character, it was about desperation. What do you do when you can't do what you want to do, which was being an actor? How far will you go as an actor to do something?
Right.
So there's sort of very different ways in to tell the story. And so a lot of the scenes were negotiated around what was the intention of the way that Dustin delivered dialogue or played certain scenes. And Sidney was, you know, masterful with that. And he, you know, if you think about that cast, he has Dustin, who comes from Method, because Terry Garr comes from Method. He's got Jessica Lange, who doesn't want to have any conversation or any rehearsal. She's a very instinctual actor.
Right.
Actor. You have Bill Murray, who doesn't even read the material. And he just sort of improvs it out. And there are various other, you know, people circling around there as well. And so, you know, here's Sidney, you know, trying to direct these very different actors who have very different approaches to acting. And he was incredible in how he did that. And that's the kind of stuff I learned that you couldn't learn in a film, in a book, or in a class.
What was the most valuable thing you learned? And go on with your story. But what was the most valuable thing you learned from Sidney Pollack about being a director?
There are so many. There are so many. But I would say that basically the value of the breath. And what I mean by that is, if you look at a lot of films right now, especially in TV, there is no breath. There's no moment between when somebody delivers. They think about what you said and you go on. And if you look at really great movies, you see the actors, the directors allowing the actors to take that moment, and that the character is really leading plot as opposed to the plot leading character.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me is like a really successful approach to making good character-based movies.
Storytelling.
So I learned a lot of that because my dad was, you know, my dad, although he did some wonderful films like, you know, Slaughterhouse-Five, most of his big films were, you know, these action adventure disaster films, airports and earthquakes and all of that.
Right.
And those were very plot-driven films.
Right.
And they were there for a purpose, and they were commercial, and they made $1 zillion and blah, 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 blah. But as far as, you know, when you're young and you're idealistic and you're thinking about you want to be Sidney Pollack when you grow up, you know, it was incredibly influential as far as how I approached, you know, my career moving forward.
Right.
So what? Getting back to the parking lot story. So what happened is that in the big reveal of Tootsie, where the Dorothy Michaels character pulls off the wig and reveals herself as Michael Dorsey on Stairway Live on TV, is that Dustin claimed that Sidney changed the text on him the night before, and Dustin was furious about it and said that. And said to me on film, he basically went to film, he says, you know, like, you know, this is criminal. You know, why would he do this to me? He says, I'm like, there's nobody who improvises better than I do. Meaning that the character had to improvise these lines as he was going down the stairs, because the Dorothy Michaels character is sort of making this up on the run as she's coming down the stairs. So Dustin was like, I can act improvisational. I don't need somebody to screw me up with dialogue that I'm searching for lines. Now, Sidney denied that. He said, I didn't either. There were some line changes and things like that, but it was certainly not a rewrite of the scene. I mean, I wouldn't do that. You know, and so, anyway, they wound up in this huge fight of which Mike Ovitz came in from CAA and negotiated between the two of them, because they were both clients.
Wow.
And the film shut down at that time for $80,000 a day. And we were all in the television control booth. I mean, I was there. Anyway, this was the one time that Sidney did not let me on the set, because it had to do with Ovitz. And Ovitz was not part of the thing.
Right.
And so I was just sitting there, we were watching them, like, and Ovitz was talking, and Sidney and Dustin are walking back and forth, no one's talking to each other, and Sidney's saying, look, I'm off this film, you know, get Bob Benton to come in, you know, you like Bob Benton, he's done, you know, Kramer versus Kramer with Dustin, and he says, oh, I'm out, you know, life's too short, I'm out of here. And so, you know, of course that didn't happen, and Dustin's like, no, don't leave, we can work this out. And anyway, they wound up working it out, they finished the movie. When Dustin came out of the Dorothy makeup into Michael Dorsey,
mm-hmm.
he already warned everybody. He said, because he's a method actor, he says, all the shit that I'm carrying forward is going to come out in Michael Dorsey, and Michael Dorsey's an asshole. And so we're all waiting for, you know, Dustin to become this, you know, horrible, horrible person. He never did. But, you know, he was so pissed off about this whole thing, and I don't think he had any confidence in the film, in what was happening with the film. And so anyway, flash forward, Sidney cuts the film, I'm cutting my film, and I get a call from him. And he says, I'm screening the first cut to Dustin and Lisa, who's been his wife, I think he's famous, probably still married. And Lisa, will you go watch it with them? And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, I'd seen some things in the editing room because I was, you know, over there with him, but I hadn't seen the film cut together. And so I thought it was sort of an odd choice for me to go with them. But I went, okay, fine. So it's Dustin, Lisa, me, and I believe it was Lee Gottsagen, who was Lisa's brother, who was working for Dustin as sort of like his executive assistant.
Right.
And anyway, it's a very small group of people.
Sure.
And we watched the movie. And like, I mean, it's great. I'm like loving it. But they don't laugh at all. Nobody laughs. And I'm loving it. So we go to the bathroom. Now, I'm standing next to Dustin at the urinal. And Dustin says to me something like, he says, you know, you and I are going to go out and make our own documentary about what really happened on this movie or something like that. And I'm like, okay, whatever, you know, whatever. So anyway, I'm wondering what's going to happen. So he's storming, and the way the Columbia parking lot was at the time is that as you come into, I think the entrance is, I think it's gate 2 or whatever, is that there's Columbia Pictures is on one side, of their offices are on one side, and Warner Brothers and everything else is on the other side. So Sidney's office was on the second floor balcony in the last office in the corner. So as we emerged from where the screening rooms were, he's diagonally across this huge parking lot. I mean, big, like maybe 1,000 cars in there. I think, yeah, certainly hundreds and hundreds of cars. And Dustin starts to spew. And the spit's coming out of his mouth. And he's going crazy. And Sidney's like smoking a cigarette. I mean, I don't think Sidney could hear him, but he could see that Dustin was going nuts. And I just see, you know, Sidney like motioning, going, come on in, let's talk about it. And Sidney's like sitting there carrying on. And I left at that point. I mean, like, this is not the place I should really be. I'm going to go Dubai. I'm out of there. I watched it for a little bit, but then I like left. And I don't know if Dustin ever went in to see Sydney or not. But anyway, it ultimately, you know, became the movie that it became. And it's hugely successful and a beautiful film. And Dustin was amazing in it. And it's funny because just this year I was researching my new book, Letters from Hollywood, and I decided to look through the Tootsie files, which were in the Academy Library. And lo and behold, I came across some legal documents that included my documentary in it, because there was some lawsuits. I'm pretty sure there were lawsuits around something to do with the movie, and I don't know what. But anyway, I saw my documentary as part of these, like, document parts of the lawsuit, and or the alleged lawsuit. I don't know if it ever went into anything. So, like, all these years later, I saw this. And then, and so that was the story. And with my experience, and Sydney and I stayed friends until his death. And I've seen Run into Dustin once in all these years. And I've reached out to him a couple of times, but haven't gotten any response. And, you know, that was that.
So let's talk let's talk for half a moment about famous people, because clearly you were working with famous people. And I'm curious, I think many people would be curious. You've been around a lot of celebrated and talented people. Can you identify or put your finger on what, if you're able to, I don't know if you will, but can you identify what makes a person stand out and become a star? Do you know what that thing is? Is it definable? Is it learnable?
Wow, you're talking about Clara Bow now, right? It's real.
Yes.
So I don't know. I mean, it is this speciality that makes somebody jump off the screen and be real. I mean, certainly technique, you know, acting technique and honesty and being true to your character, you know, can make you a very good actor if you buy into it. But you can be a very, very good actor that is not a movie star.
Right.
And it becomes becomes a combination of, I think, a lot of different qualities and you know, relatability, you know, looks, truthfulness, you know, all these sort of things go into it. But it's fascinating you ask this question, because I've been thinking about celebrity and stardom a lot lately.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was driving down the 101 freeway here in Los Angeles, and this pink Corvette cut me off. and you know where I'm going with this one, right?
Yeah, I do.
Anyway, the woman in the pink car Corvette, for anybody who doesn't know, her name is Angeline.
Angeline,
in the early 1980s, she took a billboard out on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
And, you know, big boob blondie girl who drives around in a pink Corvette. And she never sang. She didn't dance. She didn't do really anything. I mean, she did, like, sort of, like, but nobody knew about it. And nobody knew what this damn billboard was about. Like, who is this Angeline? And this ran forever. And she's, like, driving around this pink Corvette and all this. So now we flash forward, like, 40 years later. She's, like, probably 70 years old about now. And she cuts me off. And I'm starting to think, Jesus, she's still around. And my daughter had said she'd seen her, like, a few months ago.
Oh, sure.
And so I reach out to her management, because I'm like, there is something really interesting here in the story. Maybe I'll make a documentary. I don't know what it is, but I want to go talk to her about it. So I reach out to her management, arranged a meeting, and I brought my friend Todd Robinson, a director and writer, just did a wonderful film called The Last Full Measure.
Mm-hmm.
With Samuel Jackson and Peter Fonda and William Hurt. Great film coming out this year. And I said, come with me to this and tell me if, like, I'm onto something. And what I was looking at is, what is the definition of stardom? What makes a star? Like what you just asked.
Exactly.
And, like, clearly, what makes this person? I started to think, like, my God, Angeline is like the Kardashians. I mean, what the hell is, you know, what did the Kardashians ever do?
Way before the Kardashians.
Way before the Kardashians. I said, so what is this about? What makes somebody a star? And so I went and talked to her about it, and I tried to get into the inside of her, like, what did you want to do when you were 17 years old? What was the dream? I mean, did you want to be an actor? Anyway, she was pretty vacuous. I mean, she was really vacant about, or not wanting to access those areas. And so I reached out to a sociologist at UCLA named Gabriel Rossman. And I asked him, what is this about? You know, and he actually said, you know, they're models. They're mathematical models, and sociologists have studied this phenomenon for a long time. And he says, there's a lot of different theories, but it really comes down to two things. he says, one, the first thing is that it's you need an event to kick it off. So Kim Kardashian had the sex tape.
Right.
And Angelina had the billboards.
Right.
So now you have the sex tape, and now you want to be part of conversation. You want to be part of the group. Did you see Kim Kardashian's sex tape? No, wait a minute. And you go look at it, and pretty soon you want to, hey, did you see the Kim Kardashian sex tape? And pretty soon that becomes the viral thing. And then they stop talking about the sex tape because now she has celebrity and someone wants to do a TV show on her. And now she's got the TV show. And that's the impetus to moving forward. So it has to do with being relatability. And so that's, I mean, there are other theories as well, but it's like if you're on an airplane, and you're sitting next to somebody and you want to talk, you better be aware of what's going on in popular culture. NBA, you know, movies, stardom, the current viral trend, whatever it is. So there needs to be something that starts that in motion. But then we are followers as people because we don't want to be isolated. So we have to partake in that. So that was an interesting, I mean, it's sort of like a tangent to what you were asking, but, you know, this whole idea of what makes a movie star, you know, what separates them. I mean, it's not necessarily relatable in that way because movie stars generally can act really well. Unless you get somebody who's, like, just so incredibly beautiful and they put her in a, you know, in a movie where that's all she is.
Right.
People, you know, guys are attracted to that and they, you know, want to post her on, you know.
That's not going to last. When you talk about that, I mean, you know, something like that's pretty short term, even if it's several
right.
years. But someone who is an actual star, like a Dustin Hoffman, it goes on and on for a good long time.
Well, Angelina's been doing 40 years, so you can tell me that.
Yeah, that's true.
Whatever in her universe, that's a success.
She like the Kardashians. She's famous for being famous. Or Paris Hilton.
Exactly. But you know, your question is a valid question. I think that if we knew the answer, we'd all be millionaires.
Well, of course.
Movies and movie stars.
Of course.
And then there's the faded movie stars. You know, what is that about? And that's again gets back to our culture. You know why? You know, there's amazing actors, especially actresses, who've sort of aged out from the business. And there's only a few exceptions. I mean, there's you know Meryl and Keaton and. But you know where's Sally Field these days? Where's Glenn Close has made an appearance? You know there are a lot of Goldie. I mean there are a lot of people who have had you know really nice careers and you know commanded box office that they can't really find much work. You know on their terms.
And yet they're still known as stars, but it's hard for them to get cast.
I think part of that has to do with
what's being written that seems like it's valuable to the studios. So there's a bit of a catch-22 in there for a famous person who ages out is that they can't find the right work anymore because it's not there.
Can't find the right work, and as you know, because you know you've been around this a long time.
Yeah.
I mean the whole approach to making movies today is incredibly different than it was.
Very.
20 years ago.
Very.
You know, and I mean, I remember, I mean, my dad, when my dad did Earthquake in 74, he was, I think, the first guy to use the word event. And what his idea about that was he wanted to give people a reason to go to the studio,
yep.
go to the theaters and
yep.
be, like, entertained like, in a huge way. And he was sort of, ahead of the game as far as, you know, what we see now. And you know, I certainly miss the old days. I mean, you know, unless, you know, look at the Academy Awards, you find, you know, you can see these wonderful films that sort of emerge from the pack. But I don't think that there are many of these movies here other maybe than A Star Is Born or, you know, Black Panther. I mean, there are a couple of them that did also were popular films, and you're starting to see a merge of that. But it's tough to get. You couldn't make Tootsie today. You know, I don't think you could make Deer Hunter today. I don't think you could make Apocalypse today. I don't think you could make Being There today. You know, I don't think those movies would get made.
No, those mid-level movies are pretty much gone. It's either very, very low-budget movies or it's super, super high-budget movies. And I think part of that is reflected in what we just saw at the Oscars this year in that they opened the door to more big-budget commercial films like Pink Panther. Black Panther.
I know.
There's
yeah.
where my head is.
I like Pink Panther better than Black Panther.
Well, in any event, I've actually written for the Pink Panther, so that's what went through my head. But Black Panther emerged as a nominee because it's now thought of as a valid piece of storytelling, whereas in not very long ago it would not have been, and the Academy opened the doors to it. So that's either going to result in even more big budget movies like that, or perhaps people will start to think, well, wait a minute, Green Book won, Black Klansman did not, but those are mid-level movies. Why can't we make more of those? One would hope that that would start to come back into the fold. But that said, most of what the used to be mid-level movies are really now becoming HBO and Showtime series. And so that's where they've gone.
And it's great, but I mean, it's, you know, for the young filmmaker today, I mean, there's just so many places to go and to get good material made. The problem is, which is really interesting today, is that because all of these premium cable outlets and even the networks, they have identified a specific demo. So, like, in the old days, you could, like, say, okay, here's a great story. I'm going to take it to CBS, NBC, ABC.
Right.
You know, blah, blah, blah. And you could do that. Now you're going, okay, well, Lifetime is women, so it's got to have the women person. You know, somebody else is looking for male-oriented action. Someone only wants limited series. Someone only wants, you know, full series. And, you know, this person needs to have an ethnic cast. This person is, you know, so it's very hard to, like, spend a lot of time on a pitch and preparing something and know that you only really have one shot on that pitch. And that makes it more difficult, even though there are more places to go. And
definitely. Definitely.
Or sell to.
Isn't that a strange dichotomy there where, yes, there are way more places to pitch to, but actually very few of them within that large range that are right for what you're trying to pitch? So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you a story that hit us last year. I told them a miniseries, a six-hour miniseries to CBS. It had a very good writer attached to it. Very hot writer, and the idea was called "Pardon Me," the story of Patty Hearst.
Okay,
but it was a black comedy, in a way. And even though we told the story, there was so much ridiculousness that went on within the Hearst Empire and the food thing, and there was a lot of parallels to what's happening now. And it was really on the edge in the approach and the tone. And CBS loved that project. And then the head of movies there had a heart attack, and he decided not to come back to work. And a new person came in, and that new person cleaned house on all the projects,
of course,
including ours, which was ready to go. Okay, but because we chose that tone on it, there was no place else to go to. Nobody wanted to touch it. And it was right around the Tubin book came out, and there was other sensitivities. But if we had gone more of a straight-ahead way, we probably would have had more opportunities to do it, or maybe they would have said, no, we don't want to do it because Fox is developing a feature. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. But it's just, you would think that a project that was as high concept as that project, and written by such a well-known writer, and had production company attached to it along with me, that, you know, it would have a shot in the market, and it just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't.
It's
and
a shame.
That's the reality of the business.
Yeah,
I mean,
It's really,
you know,
topsy-turvy.
Yeah. Go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I make a couple more. A billion stories on this. No, it's all right. It's just that's the way it is, so it's hard. You know, it's so much harder than now than it was, you know, when I was coming through, you know, through. On the other hand, which is something Sidney Pollack told me, is he said, you know, what's interesting now is that, you know, when I was growing up and when, you know, he was growing up, he was much older than I was, but that, you know, it was very hard to get any film to present because, you know, as a first-time director, they say, well, what have you shot? You know, I didn't shoot anything. It was very expensive to shoot anything.
Of course.
You know, Super 8, the optical was married to the magnetic was married to the film. So, you know, there's all sync issues and it never looked great. And, you know, it's awful. How do you show it? You bring in your Super 8 projector. I mean, it's a big mess. And so now you have this incredible ability to, like, on your iPhone even, you know, go out and shoot something.
Absolutely.
And so what Sidney said, and he's been gone, I don't know, 10 years now, and, you know, he said to me that, like, he would just get a DVD in the mail, or a VHS in the mail, and he put from some kid who shot something in Iowa, and he'd, you know, throw it into the projector, and he'd throw it into the TV, and he'd look at it, and he says, you know, it may not be perfect, but there might be an idea in there. There might be something interesting in it. If there's something, the idea in there is something interesting, then I want to talk to that kid. And so in some ways, that is a better way to get your stuff known, because you can, you know, send links, you can do a lot of different things with it to get attention when you're a young filmmaker today. So there are more avenues, and it's easier, but it's also harder.
Because I teach at a film school here in Pittsburgh, we see the amazing things that young people can do when given a chance with that certain kinds of equipment. Now, we provide all this equipment to them when they come to school, and it's much better than it was way back in the day when you were in school and I was in school, and UCLA, USC, and so on. It was a huge deal to try and make something of any substance. Now, with this equipment, they can do all kinds of things, including effects, you know? So it's a very different world we're living in.
Well, it certainly is. And anyway, I'm surviving. I'm out here.
so
getting up the bat. And try to...
Let's talk about some of the work you've done. When you're producing or directing a movie or whatever, obviously it comes in with various built-in pressures. How do you deal with pressure? Do you have any tried and true tricks for dealing with the everybody's all roads are leading to you kind of world?
Well, there was a moment in my life which changed my perspective about all this pressure. And that was when my daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and when she was very young. And up until that point, I was incredibly driven and, you know, very much like a lot of people you see, you know, they wanting to make their mark in the world when they're young and, you know, follow your dreams and accomplish your dreams. I was very fortunate when Nikki had diabetes, had already done 3 features and had done some television. And, you know, I and my wife at that point had left me and moved away for me to take care of my 2 children. So I sort of single parented my kids. And, the fact that my daughter was ill and we're going to be dealing with this, it sort of put life in perspective for me. That combined with the fact that my dad had this horrendously debilitating stroke, which took away his voice, his ability to speak and walk. Those 2 things came pretty close together. And I started to say, you know what? Don't sweat the small stuff. And it forced me to sort of back off of the directing part and be more of a producer and sort of teach myself how to write so I could be around more. And so what that did is at any time that the crap, you sort of like, I don't know what your requirements are, but the stuff hits the fan here, you know, I try to just put it into perspective and go, you know, this is not saving lives. This is not, you know, life and death. You know, this is just, you have to be dealt with and move it over. And this aggravation and this stress will move away, and there'll be something else down the line that upsets you in a week or so. So it's just another, stress is like a bus. They're going to keep coming by. They're going to leave. They're going to come by, and they're going to leave. And just sort of like try to be zen with it as much as you can. That doesn't mean that at times it becomes incredibly maddening and incredibly frustrating.
Right.
And I will tell you, the type of story that happened recently that was frustrating and stressful, and I just let it go. And that is that I had, along with a partner, we had set up a project at one of the networks. And I can't say the network because I've got a project there, but I had one of the networks. And it's taking forever to get an answer. Are they going to buy this thing or not buy this thing? And, you know, we submitted it in, and we had the pitch, and, you know, they liked it, but there's no deal yet. And they call up, and, they, you know, when we call them up, and we say, what's going on? Say, well, we're doing a concept focus group. I'm like, what? Like a concept focus group? Oh, yeah, we, like, sit around with a bunch of people, and we, like, run these one-liners by them, and we see if they're, like, interested in it. So, like, now, you know, the writer, we've been working, like, 3 or 4 months on constructing a story and a pitch and getting rights and, like, working on character arcs and blah, 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 blah. And now this one line of my movie idea is going to be pitched to, like, 12 people to see whether or not they like the concept.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whatever. Okay, so now you wait, like, a couple weeks. We're evaluating information, call back. Well, how'd it go? Yeah, you tested really well. He says, now we're going to go to the treatment focus group. Okay, same sort of thing. Like, they're going to give, like, them 3 pages and, you know, talk about it and see what it is. Anyways, all this goes down the road, and finally the deal happens, and it's, like, a year later. You know, and it's like you're going, and my money doesn't come in until the movie gets made. So I'm like, you know, what you know, this is, it's really frustrating, really stressful. So, you know, what can you do? You can go crazy and shoot yourself, or you go, you know what? It's going to take them 6 months to do it, whatever it is. You have no control of it. Embrace the uncertainty. You can't make the move faster. This is great. Now you have time to develop five other projects while they're making up their minds what to do. So it's a, it, I've learned this approach to try to just audibilize at the line sort of and go, okay, well, this is upsetting me. The receivers are covered, whatever. I'm going to go right and hand it off or something. And I just make that audible, and it sort of saves me the high blood pressure and the sleepless nights and the rapid heart rates and all the things that I had when I was a kid.
Right.
Which was all the time.
Right.
And that's not to say that, like, on occasion that I will lose it and yell at somebody. Rare. It's very, very rare. But I it can happen under the right circumstances. And it usually has to do with multiple things leading up to finally something that sets me off.
Sure.
But I think if you're going to be in the movie business, you know, for real, you have to do it for a couple of reasons. The main thing I think it has to be is that it's your canvas for saying something that's important to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not talking about from a person who wants to make films, not necessarily someone who's like wants to be in the movie business and be an executive or make a lot of money. Because if you're going to want to make a lot of money, this is the wrong business to make it in. Unless you get lucky. But look at how many.
Right.
I mean, it's the same like how many people are playing in the NBA versus
exactly.
how many people are playing basketball.
Exactly.
It can happen, and that's what we all look to. That's the dream. That's the big pie in the sky. We're going to be like this person.
Sure.
But the reality is that, you know, you have to love what you do, and that's why I still do what I do, is upsetting and it's frustrating. It's been over the year, is that, you know, I love the idea of storytelling. I love the idea of bringing something that's important to me into the, you know, for other people to share, because I think I'm a pretty normal guy. I go back to a conversation I had with a friend of mine who has been, Mark Platt. I can say Mark Platt is wonderful, one of the best producers around.
He's definitely.
He did the Reese Witherspoon School, like girl going to Harvard Law School, I forgot what it's called. But anyway, he's just a lot of great films. And we were talking one day many years ago when he was president of Universal about they were looking for like sort of the next Godzilla, whatever the next movie was, next big movie. They were looking for that. And we wound up in this conversation about like, Mark, I was like, Mark, you know, what makes you feel good? What makes you angry? What makes you happy? You know, what do you like? And I said, you're a pretty normal guy. I'm a pretty normal guy. You know, why are we chasing like the next big thing instead of sort of looking at like what really moves us in a commercial sense, because we're in a business of making money, you know, what can we do that's commercial that is also like makes us really excited? And it may be Godzilla. Maybe that's your thing that you want to do. But I just never felt that you need to chase the next big thing, because if you have something that's true to you and you're a pretty normal guy and girl, the guy or girl, and those feelings, those sort of, you know, basic feelings of anger, happiness, love, hate, those things can be communicated in characters, that it's going to resonate with a lot of people, depending on what obviously the canvas is. You can't have that happening in a small bathroom, you know, and make a commercial movie. But you look at those themes and you find them, and you can see these great movies, you know, Back to the Future. I mean, the commercial movies, but even Superbad, that the teen comedy was a wonderful script. You know, just a, you know, Ferris Bueller, you know, again, you know, you can look at these movies that were the old movies, and even movies today that have those themes in it. And so someone, like, cared about it.
Right.
And we had the guts to make it.
Well, right.
So, anyway, I don't know.
Who knows if I'm right? It's all about passion one way or another. It's all about somebody's got to have, I'm sure your father got very passionate about certain projects, you know. My dad did.
It's a different era, though. He definitely did. He was super excited. He was very supportive of the filmmakers who worked for him. But, you know, we come at it very differently. I don't know how old you are or where your parents are came from, but both of my parents were depressed babies.
Mm-hmm.
And both of my parents had to figure out a way to put food on the table. Okay, they were the greatest generation. They, you know, went through World War II, and they went through the Depression. They went through all this stuff. And And so their formative years and what they wanted to do was form very differently than our generation, my generation, and my children's generation, because we have food on our tables. You know, we're not looking for our next paycheck to live on. And so that it's easy for me to sit here and say, oh, it's all about passion and bringing the art to the screen. Because, you know, my dad and my mom, they had to do what they had to do in order to make it work for themselves.
Sure.
And so I think when my dad decided to do Earthquake in the airport movies, they may have not been the movies that were the most moving to him, but they were the movies that made the most sense for him to keep doing what he wanted to do, which is to be an executive at Universal and making movies and be able to provide for his family. So there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
And that's what I say. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are like, oh, you know, what a sellout. Or, well, you know, this guy sold out on that. Well, you don't know what that person's situation is. And why is that person not entitled to make the movie that they want to make? You know, whatever that movie is, it's your choice to go see it. But don't, you know, degrade somebody because they want to make a big action movie because they want to make a lot of money. It's just not where my heart is.
Well, sometimes,
I'm respectful.
Yeah, sure. Sometimes folks in the position that your father eventually got to at Universal and so on, once he gets involved in a project, one would like to think that even if it wasn't the ideal thing that he wanted to do, he became a heavy-duty advocate for it, and that he worked his butt off for it, and that he was passionate about making it work. And I think without that, you're in trouble.
100%. With Earthquake, that was his idea. I mean, he got that idea when we had an earthquake here in L.A., and I had I came into my room and I was under my desk because that's what we were taught in school, you know, drop and cover for nuclear bombs.
Right.
Drop and cover for earthquakes. And so, you know, he was really sort of moved by that. And there's this funny story, an anecdote story about earthquakes. So my dad is screening the film for exhibitors at Universal. And as you recall, it had Sense Around, which
yes.
was a technical device, won Academy Award.
Yes.
You know, allow the theater to these very sort of subwoofers to shake at the point of the earthquake. And so they were running Earthquake in one room. And in the next room, there was a group from Nicaragua who was watching another movie, and there had just been this huge Nicaraguan earthquake like that year. There were, you know, thousands of people died.
Yes.
And so we're screening the thing in our screening room. And the Sense Around comes out, and we hear all this screaming and this crazy crying and yelling. And, you know, look outside, and this whole Nicaragua delegation is, like, running from the street because the walls were shaking from our screening room to their screening room.
And now, today, so many movie theaters that we have where there's a movie next door that has explosions and big sound effects, it feels like Sense Around in the theater that you're in next door. That's more common today than not, you know. But your father, did he come up with Sense Around? Was that his idea?
Yeah, well, he was always looking, you know, looking for these event things. So, yeah, he wanted to figure out how to make the earthquake actually sound like an earthquake. I mean, he also was playing around with a script that actually I just was reading yesterday. It's 30, 40 years old, called Lightning. It's like a Key Largo story about a woman who has fear of lightning, and it's a thriller. It's a really, but he was working with this guy from the Air Force who harnessed lightning, and was trying to work out ways that like lightning would happen in the theater, and like the winds.
Hmm.
So you'd watch this movie, and winds would be coming, and you know. So that didn't happen, but he was always thinking on that sort of edge, and how do you make an event happen?
Right.
And obviously, Earthquake was, you know, hugely successful, and it's got a Facebook page of rabid followers, which I watch, and I'm constantly amused by it. It's, you know, not taken seriously by this group, and it's a corny film now, you know, looking back on it.
Sure.
But it was, you know, hugely successful. I mean, you think about it, it was a $6 million budget. It, you know, made a lot of money.
A lot of money.
You know, in those days.
Have you ever seen in a theme park this thing called 4D? Have you ever seen that?
I have, and I've heard it. I you know, since my kids are adults now, I've not been to the theme park in probably 15 years.
Right. So they have. Your father would have loved this. They have these little mini theaters, and they'll show a cartoon or something like that. They'll show Ice Age or something like that. It's a short, but you're in a motion-based seat. and it has wind that blows at you, and it has a character will sneeze and water will fly in your face, and the seats move. So it's like a little mini event. I don't think you could do a whole movie that way. I think people would get sick, but for a short, it works very well.
Well, you know, back in the day, now you have, you know, the VR and, you know, and AR and all that happening, which I've dabbled in a little bit. But before all this, and maybe 15, 20 years ago, there's a name Don Iwerks. And,
sure.
Iwerks, you remember Iwerks? Well, Iwerks is similar to what you're talking about.
You know who Don Iwerks was? Don Iwerks was Ub Iwerks' son.
And, oh, really?
And Ub Iwerks was one of the original animators for Walt Disney.
Ah, well, then you're well aware of this. We'll just leave your listeners out of it. It'll be our story. But yeah. Anyway, the thing was they had the tracks. They were tied to this motion controlled unit, and you'd sit in it. And,
yeah.
You know, the roller coasters flying and all of that. And so, yeah. So it's all evolving. I don't know where it's going to ultimately go to.
But here's the thing, it all still revolves around storytelling. When you put people into, whether it's a theme park or on a cable channel or in a motion picture theater, it doesn't matter. People still need the context of story. And without that, it's just stuff. Let me ask you one question before we move on toward the end of the show here. This is a really hard question. I ask lots of people this, and you know, people struggle with this question. Maybe you have a good answer. What to you makes a good story good?
I think we covered that in a lot of ways. I think it all starts with character. You know, it character drives the plot. And I think that, you know, if you know, my friend Todd Robinson again, I think I allude to it a little bit in my book that you read, Going Up Hollywood. But
yeah.
I think that what he does, and he's not the only one who does it. He taught me to do it. Is that he does a lot of character bibles and outlines before he writes any of the story. So he gets inside of every single character, you know, what they do, what they think, what their favorite color is, what their favorite number is, you know, where they like to vacation, what music they like, all this stuff, so that he understands who that person is completely. It's not just sitting in fade in. Joan sits at a table, you know, playing cards, blah 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 blah. He knows why Joan's playing cards, why she's sitting at the table, what happened before she sat at the table, where she's going after she's at the table, what her plans are tonight. You know, he's got all that stuff out, regardless if it winds up in the text or in the transitions or anything else in the script.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you do that for your, you know, six, seven major characters. You pretty much know who they are, and they become real as you tell the story.
Right.
And then obviously you have to create the story and, you know, the turns and all of that. So I would just say that be patient with it. You know, that's the thing, and understand that.
It's the creation of three-dimensional characters. That's what you're talking about, which is absolutely critical to making a story come to life. Because stories are plentiful. There are lots of stories in the world and lots of variations of the same stories that we've seen over and over again, but executed in wonderful ways. But it is when we put unique three-dimensional characters in conflict with other unique three-dimensional characters that you actually have the chance of the thing going out and becoming a huge success. Don't you agree?
I absolutely agree.
Cool.
I absolutely agree. And I still strive for that. And sometimes you're curtailed by, you know, certain requirements from the buyers, but, you know, you try to do that.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And then you know, what makes an event movie like what your dad did work better than not is not just the fanciful special effects. It's that there are characters that we care about. Because without that, then you're just doing a bunch of effects. And that doesn't carry 2 hours of a story, you know. It has to have, and that's what your dad did very well at that, by making sure that people were developing great characters, and then of course casting all the rest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. It was a fun time growing up then. I'll tell you, watching all that happen.
I bet it was. I bet you got to see some things that most people don't ordinarily get to see, and that would be fun. I know that you know, you've done a lot of work with a lot of people. And a lot of what you've done requires one form of collaboration or another, whether it's on a set or pre-production or post-production. Talk to me about collaboration. what makes a good collaboration work? I know it's like a marriage. I've heard that many times. But how, when you collaborate with people, what is it that you're, how are you operating? What are you thinking about in collaborating?
I am thinking about two primary things, and that is respect and listening. Because when you're dealing in a passionate world, which is what we're dealing with, people have strong opinions.
Right.
And they are, and at the end, they're just opinions. Because that's what's so, you know, peculiar about the movie business is that everybody thinks they know. Nobody does know because it's so, it's not like, you know, two and two is four. It's taste. It's a lot of things. You hope you get a consensus of people who like your movie so that you can be successful. But what I try to do with people is really listen to them and make sure that they know that they're listening. And if we disagree, I try to validate them by not doing, you know, you're crazy, you're an idiot, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. I see your point. I understand what you're saying, but let's look at it this way. Mm-hmm. And you sort of try to phrase it so it tries to de-escalate the potential conflict between two people when you're getting into an argument in an editing room or on the set or, you know, how the film's going to be distributed. I mean, I've been arguing back and forth with my co-writer on the new book, Letters from Hollywood, and, you know, we're very respectful with each other. It can get passionate.
Sure.
And I try to be very much to validate. I understand what you're saying. I understand your reasons, but, you know, this is how I feel. And so I think that, and so she knows she's respected, and it's filled with compliments along the way about all the good things. So it's just not, it's not just a feeling like it's an attacking way of going at somebody. It can feel that way at certain times, but yeah, I try not to go there
mm-hmm.
with it. And a lot, and to be honest with you, you know, control and collaboration changes because, you know, at some point, you know, you're in charge of the whole thing. When you're like, when I'm creating a project, I'm the only guy. And then, you know, I bring someone in, I choose somebody to be a strategic partner with me. And at this age, I only want to work with people I like. I don't want to work with people who aggravate me.
Well, of course.
You know, at a certain time of my life, you do whatever you're going to do. So I try to find somebody that I have a relationship with and I've worked with before that I can trust. And then the respect is already there. So then that's that. And then it's getting to listening. And then what happens is you eventually have to surrender that project. You surrender that project to the person who's financing the project.
Yeah.
And now you've given up that control. And so now you're just sort of like trying to, you know, keep the rudder straight on the boat and make sure it doesn't tip over and, you know, go through the storm the best that you can and not get blown overboard. And you know, you get to the end and, you know, they're arguing and they're making really stupid comments and, you know, crazy stuff. You try to do the best you can, but you have to realize that, you know, we're in a business and this person is paying you for a job
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you want to keep working in the business. So, you know, you're going to have to be, you know, diplomatic in how you do it. And at the end of the day, the movie will be done and seen and you'll be on to the next project. And that's really the attitude of someone who's been battered and beaten over, you know, 40 years in the business. It's not how I was when I was younger. And I wouldn't tell a young filmmaker to be as easygoing as I am. You know, I would say fight. You know, fight for your beliefs and what you want. At this point in my life, it's really about getting my daughter through law school
yeah.
and doing good material.
Right.
You know, and I don't do bad material. I mean, I won't do bad stuff and I won't take projects that are just commercial for the sake of being commercial. I'll never take a project that's exploiting or objectifying women. You know, there are rules that I have for myself. But that, you know, I'll also do a project that I think it can sell that is not the love of my life. And just because, but it's still going to be good. There's going to be something in it that I really like.
Sure.
But it may not be the end-all, be-all project. Different than when you're young and you're idealistic and you know, have a mark to make.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that changes people dramatically in Hollywood is when they finally do get married and do have a child, and suddenly they have to put a lot of food on the table. And so
right.
that makes people think a little bit differently than when they're 20 years old. I'm curious about, you know, you clearly have had plenty of dealings with studio executives, network executives, other producers, and so on. How do you handle notes, especially notes that you disagree with or that you think may be wrong? What technique do you have for dealing with things that you think are off the mark?
It's so interesting you say this, and it goes back to part of our earlier conversation about where I said my dad told me to try to know all sides of the business. So And the fact that I am a writer and I also am a producer, and I've directed, although not many years, is that I have both given notes and taken notes.
Sure.
And the way by learning to take notes, because it was before I was writing, I see those notes very differently now than when I did then, and because I've been beaten up by the notes that I've gotten, and I've been hard before with the notes that I've given, and now, again, I'm trying to see what are the reasons that these executives have these notes for me, and are they, or for the writer, and are they reasonable, and why are they? The kind of notes that are, and you can get some really great executives. I've had like two incredible executives, three actually, who stood far above everybody else.
Right.
One was Becky Pollock at United Artists.
Yeah.
One was Julie Bergman at Warner Brothers, and one is Joan Harrison, who is at CBS. And those three executives were far and away the better executives on notes because they gave really good notes. But I've also had executives say to me, the second act isn't working. Why isn't it working? I'm not quite sure, it's just not working for me. The script isn't funny enough. What's not working for you? What's not funny? I don't know. I didn't laugh enough. Well, what did you laugh at? I can't remember. How would you like to make that? How would you like to make it funnier? I don't know. You figure it out. You know, those kind of notes you get a lot from people that make you like, are
crazy.
You kidding me? You're in this job?
Yeah.
You're in this job? And so those notes, I don't know, really know what to do with. I haven't had any notes like that in a long time. But you just try to look at what's good in the notes, and what you could really find out about is not reacting right off the bat. So it's very easy if somebody's you're in a notes meeting and you're feeling abused by your executive. And I have actually had an experience with a woman writer who was just absolutely abused by the executive at the network, and I took a lot of issue with it, with him for doing it. But it's mean-spirited stuff. But I said to her, she's crying and all that, and I said, look, try not to react. And that's what I do. Try not to react in the moment, because you're immediately offensive and you're very passionate about what you wrote, and you feel like you put your best effort into it. Someone's crapping on you and doesn't acknowledge the fact that you spent, hundreds of hours trying to figure these plot points out or what's going on in the script. And, they read it overnight with 10 other scripts, and they're going to blast you in the notes meeting. Just take the moment. Take the moment. Go back. Look at the notes. Think about, what they are. What are the notes that you can do or maybe make it better? And what are the notes that you absolutely don't agree with? And then we'll draft an email about the notes back and give reasons why these notes don't work and what they're about, and say, look, we're going to make all these changes. And we'd like to discuss these changes. And so you've sort of de-escalated the competitiveness of an executive saying, I want you to do this, and a writer, a producer saying, hell no, we're not going to do this. And now you're in a fight. And now you're in a fight for control. And that executive is going to want to win the fight. And you're going to want to win the fight. And it's only going to end with a lot of aggravation and bad feelings. So just take the moment. Think about it. Mm-hmm. Go back, de-escalate it, and then come back into it.
It's
that would be my advice, and that's what I've done pretty successfully.
It's very wise advice, because really sometimes a note, you disagree with the note, but if you think about it, you realize that they had a problem with something, and you can actually improve something that may not be the exact note, but it actually works to your advantage. Considering the notes is important.
Absolutely. And as long as we're undeveloped executives, and again, I commend the ones that are really great, I will tell you a story that my manager told me. And she went into a meeting with a newly hired development executive who was very pretty, who had come from another place in New York, didn't know whether or not she had any film experience or not. She and her partner said, we're here, we want to know what you're looking for in material. They had a bunch of clients. And this woman looked at them straight and said, well, we're looking for John Raw projects. Now, my manager has been in the business a long time, as was her partner, and they didn't know who this guy John Raw was. And they felt sort of dumb. So they were trying to play around it, and they were saying, we know John Woo, and we know John, but what is John Raw written that, that we would have seen or read? And she says, oh, my God, John Raw, thrillers. Horror movies and all these things. She had heard the word genre.
Oh my goodness.
And was presenting that. So on one hand, you get these amazing executives who give you very insightful notes. And on the other hand, you get the John Raw.
John Raw, of course.
Yes. But the next time you talk about genre movies, just say, you know, look, I really like John Raw movies.
John Raw movies. Absolutely. I love John Raw movies. All right, so you've also written, you know, a whole bunch of books, and you're working on one now that's coming out in the fall. Do you prefer writing books to movies, or are they just different skill sets?
They're different skill sets. I never really thought of it. I never even considered myself as a writer growing up. I don't think I was a very good writer. I think I taught myself to be a decent writer.
Ah, but you're a very good writer.
Do I like them more? I think that it was a fact of what we talked about, you know, raising my kids alone, wanting to not be away on location, you know, driving carpool, that, it, you know, it, I needed to create another income stream. And it was something I always wanted to challenge myself to do. And so so that's sort of what I did. What is interesting about novel writing, and I've only written one, it was without a doubt the most pleasurable experience of my entire life, is that, as you know, as a screenwriter, is that you're constrained by internal conflict.
Of course.
You clearly can't do much of it. And so when you write the novel, I mean, you can go anywhere you want. You know, she remembered when she was 6 years old. And,
sure.
You know, you go back. And so there's a freedom. There's a freedom to the writing, and there's not particularly a form to it. I mean, there's form, obviously, but it's not like a screenplay form where you're going to make an act change at, you know, page so-and-so. And you know, you've got a page count you got to get to, and there's a lot of other things in screenwriting which are different than the novel writing. The nonfiction side of the writing for me is really appeals to everything that I like. And that is one of the downsides to my career has been that I'm interested in a lot of things, so I don't get pigeonholed. And at the same time, I'm not an expert in anything if it's perceived by the business. So, for instance, you know, the diabetes books that I wrote came out of my passion for trying to help children understand their disease and, you know, why they were special and why they were no different than anybody else.
Right.
And that they shouldn't be defined by the disease. So this was something that came out of my own observations of my child. And so that became that project. And then I went through a divorce. And so I was like, oh, well, if you thought your divorce was bad, wait till you read this book. So like, I went out and I found the craziest stories of the worst divorces and wrote it in a very humorous way. And so that sort of came out of that experience. And the Hollywood books are obviously my Hollywood book. Now, the book that you read, Growing Up Hollywood, that came quite by accident. I was in a meeting for a movie pitch, and the executive there said to me, tell so-and-so about the story about your dad and Joan Bennett. And this is a legendary Hollywood Babylon story,
mm-hmm.
and it goes back to when my dad was a very young agent representing, you know, Joan Crawford and also Joan Bennett and Bogart and so forth and so on. He was young. He had an affair with screen siren Joan Bennett, who was beautiful, you know, older than he was, and her husband, who was a very terrific producer named Walter Wanger, who had done Cleopatra and I Want to Live and Riot on Cell Block, I think it was 9 or 11 or whatever. He's a wonderful producer. Ambushed my father and Joan Bennett as they were coming back from a meeting at a network for a TV show and aimed at my father's balls and shot him. And so that became the story of Jennings Lang got shot in the balls. Well, clearly he wasn't shot in the balls because, you know, I'm here to talk to you today, but nevertheless, that story became, you know, front page news across the country and sort of, you know, ruined, you know, her career and so forth and so on. So I'm telling the story, and I'm telling it in the framework of how I found out about it as a 13-year-old kid and in elementary school. And if you can imagine the morning, I'm at elementary school and I'm you know, playing basketball and I'm, you know, whatever, 12, 13 years old, and my best friend comes running across this blacktop yelling, "Hey, Lang, my mother said your father was shot in the balls. Hey, Lang, my mother said your father was shot in the balls." And the whole playground, like, stops. Like those movies, like, EFI, like, everybody stops. And I'm like, "What are you talking about, dude?" You know, it's like, so he tells me this story that his mother told him. And, like, all day long, I'm thinking about my dad was shot in the balls. Are you kidding me? My dad was shot in the balls. You know, and I'm like thinking, like, can he pee? I don't, you know, I'm 13. I'm like, can he pee? What's going on with him? And I'm watching this clock go by, and like, you know, people are asking me all day long about it, and I don't know, and I just can't wait to get home. I can't wait to get home and ask my dad this. So I run in the house, and I run up to my mom's second floor. I run up to my mom's room, and I'm like, Mom, Andy Stewart's mom said dad got shot in the ball. And she's like putting on her lipstick. She says, you're going to have to wait until your dad gets home to ask him that. So now I've got like a whole afternoon waiting for my dad to come home from work. And like, you know, so my dad. So anyway, the story is it's a funny story, and it's like all through my eyes I'm telling the story. And so I come home for dinner, and my kids are there. And this was a couple of years ago, so they're, you know, they're in their 20s. And they'd heard the story a little bit. And I tell them the story through my point of view, just not the fact that it happened. And they are hysterical. And they're saying, Dad, you got to write this down. You got to write this down. We can never tell it like you can tell it. You've got to write this down. Okay, fine. So I write the story. My mother said your father was shot in the balls. And I start thinking about all these other crazy stories I had with my dad. You know, it's like crazy stuff. And so out of that came this book called Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul.
Right.
Anyway, so out of it came this book. And I self-published it. I really wrote it for the family. And it's very self-deprecating, and it's hilarious. You know, I hope it's hilarious.
It's hilarious.
And so it wound up having this, like, I started getting phone calls from people in Hollywood about it. And I even got a phone call from a legendary executive and producer, a guy named Jay Cantor, who did The Right Stuff. And he calls me and says, I'm at Polly Bergen's funeral, and I just read your book, and it's great. I'm like, you're calling me from Polly Bergen's funeral? Tell me the book is great? I said, thanks, Jay. It's like, so it's sort of like, it was really fun to do that and to get this out, and people keep asking me to write a sequel. But, you know, I've got a few more stories, but I pretty much laid it all out in this book, and it's sort of, that was that. And I'm someone who sort of like moves on after a project to the next project.
Well, and on that note, we're a good 80 minutes into this wonderful show with all this incredible stuff. So I'm going to give you the last two questions of the day, which are, you know, we've heard a ton of stories already from you, but do you have any specific story that it just sort of stands above the rest, that's either from all your experiences, either quirky or oddball or offbeat or weird or just flat out funny beyond what we've already heard? Do you have one of those?
Yeah, well, many are in the book, but I'll tell you a story that turned out with a good ending, was scary as hell. And that is that when I was on the set of Tootsie, Bill Murray was late to the set one day. And so, as I said, I had full control. I don't know what happened to him, but he was very late, several hours late. And so, you know, my camera was on, and, you know, when he walked on the set, I was shooting everything on the set. So nothing happens, you know, whatever, he works it out, whatever his excuse was, it was legit or not legit, I have no idea. But anyway, so the next day, I'm setting up to shoot an interview, and Murray comes approach me, like, and grabs me and pushes me up against the wall. and he thinks, like, I'm a kid, Bill Murray's a kid. And he thinks that, like, I work for National Enquirer, or I'm working for Inside Edition, something like that, and I'm going to put this film out about how irresponsible he was and whatever this thing was, I was shooting a wide shot of him coming in the set. I mean, it was nothing. There was no intention behind it. And so anyway, I'm up against the wall, and he's got his fist at me, and he looks like he's going to punch me. And he's like, he's calling me names. And so the assistant director, a wonderful guy, Bill, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Bill, it's fine. So I said, Bill, go ask Sydney. I'm working for Sydney. Go ask Sydney. So he walks over to Sydney, and I see them across the thing, like, and he sort of slumps back to me really slow, his head down. He goes, "Hey man, I'm so sorry, Ed. I'm so sorry. Anything I can do for you? I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." And then from that time on, he was the best. He like gave me interviews. He gave me time. He was funny. He was great. And I could see like how he could interpret it that way.
Sure.
You know, but at the time I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get punched out by Bill Murray. This is going to be a hell of a story. I hope he doesn't do any damage. And so, but it, you know, it turned out great. And Bill was great. And he was very funny in the documentary. And, you know, it turned out so that was a sort of an oddball, oddball story that happened.
The legendary Bill Murray. You know, that's, not everybody can say something like that, Rocky, so I think it's very cool. And last question, do you have a very strong and solid piece of advice or tip for those who are sort of trying to make their bones and get into the business, or those who are in but trying to get to that next level?
Yes, I do, and I'm going to catch it with a little bit of a story, is that I mentor young filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I do every couple of years is I write a short, and I let all young filmmakers do all the technical stuff. I direct it, and they get to have film, and they get to go on with it.
Wow.
What I've learned when talking to young filmmakers, and I usually cast like one season star in it and then let have the young actors play the other roles. We just shoot it over a weekend, and they're pretty fun to do. And so one of the things that I've noticed in talking to these young filmmakers, they fall into sort of, there's more categories. They call it two major categories. And these are the kids who want to be successful in the film business. They're the kids who will do anything. They'll learn. They want to learn. They are curious. They're sort of like I was, and want to understand every part of the film. And they'll do anything they can possibly do to learn, to be the best that they can be, to give themselves the best opportunity. The other example is like a kid who I interviewed came in from UCLA, USC Film School, not on the production side, on the, I don't know what it's called. They basically watch old movies, more than I guess the academic side.
That would be the media studies.
Media studies. So he says, he comes to meet me and he says, what do you want to do? He says, I want to be a director. I said, great. I said, what have you directed? He says, well, I haven't directed anything. I said, well, have you like been worked on movie crews or done anything? No, I haven't. I've just been in critical studies. That was his critical studies. I said, so you want to be a director and you haven't directed anything. How am I going to be able to help you and evaluate what you've done and show your stuff? I don't know. I said, well, you know, people have made, you know, movies on their iPhones, and said, you know, you should at least go out and do that. Oh, that's good. He said, well, I also want to write. I said, well, what have you written? Well, I haven't really written it, just some short stories. I said, so you've been at USC Film School for 4 years and you haven't written a single screenplay and you haven't directed a single thing of film? And at the point of it is, he thought I was an alien. He thought I was from Mars. It's like, who does that? I'm not in the production department. This is, you asked me what I want to do. I want to do this. And he's coming to me and asking. So when I look at that kid, and I look at the other kid who maybe went 2 years of junior college or something and couldn't stand it because he wanted to be working in the film, and he's working for craft services, and he's in bring coffee in an editing studio. He's going out on the weekend. He's like borrowed some camera and he's shooting something. And he's spending his nights writing a script and going to acting classes and trying to, you know, create friendships with actors and other people so that he can put his little film together. Those are sort of like two different things. So I look at the kid who is, and I hate to pat myself on the back because I was a privileged kid, but I had that same attitude. I want to learn everything. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do everything I can. I even found a notebook that I wrote when I was 17 years old, which had all these ideas about what directors did and how everything, all I had viewed and heard and things like that, because I was studying all the time. So I would, my advice to the young filmmakers is do everything that you can if you want to be in this business, to learn everything that you can, to be good as everything as you can possibly do. Because you can't be that volitional. You can say, I want to be a director, but you might have to produce in order to become a director. You may have to write to become a director.
Or edit.
So you may have to do something, or edit, or do anything. And that's a whole other thing. Editing is phenomenal for understanding how to put a movie together. But anyway, so that my advice would be is to just, you know, hone the craft, be passionate about what you want, and have a direction. Be ready to go off your direction and take another road. You know, the Robin Frost, the road less traveled. You know, you might have to take that road less traveled in order to get to where you want to go.
I think that's I think that's extraordinarily smart and wise advice.
Thank you so much.
That the more that you know, the better your chances of doing what it is that you want to do, and the less that you know, the less likely it is that you're going to have success. Not that you can't, but it's just less likely. So the great directors like the Stanley Kubricks and the Steven Spielbergs of the world, they know every single element of everything on a set. So how intelligent is it for you to say, learn everything? I think that's just great.
And Steven's a great example. And I was very close to Steven when I was young because my dad gave him Sugarland Express and he was just a kid. And I was 13, he was like 22 or something. And with Steven watched all my movies and before he became Steven Spielberg.
Wow.
I mean, he was not Steven, he was doing like crappy TV. But anyway, the point of it is Steven was like that. You know, he did everything he could to learn everything he could about
sure.
business.
Sure.
He'd do everything. He knew lenses, he knew editing, he knew how he had sense of music and pacing, story and everything. You know, he was just like that.
And it shows. And it shows in the work. And, you know, he is truly one of the masters of the masters. And it shows that he knows every bit of what goes on on a set, pre-production, post-production, all the rest of it. So, Rocky, this has just been a great treat today to have you on the show. So many wonderful stories. And perhaps when your new book comes out, we'll have you back and we can talk about even more. Because there's a whole lot more than I have for you.
Anytime.
Yeah, this is
anytime. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me today. And so we've come to the end of today's Story Beat. If you like this podcast, please take a moment to give us a comment, rating, or review on whatever app or platform you're listening to. Your support helps us bring more great episodes to you. This podcast would not have been possible without the generous support of the Center for Media Innovation on the campus of Point Park University. Until next time, I'm Steve Cuden, and may all your stories be unforgettable.